it is my kind of duty. I kind of look at it as a servant leader. I want to make sure that they have every possible tool they need to go out and be successful on another team. And I focus on that daily, like, how can I help them get to where they want to go? And it's just served me really well. And I think it served our team really well, too.
Hello, and welcome back, or welcome to, the Gestalt Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler White. In this interview, we get a chance to chat with the Arizona Diamondbacks Director of Sports Medicine and Performance, Ken Crenshaw. Ken has 30 years experience in baseball. This man is a pioneer in the industry. He has led multiple teams to Training Staff of the Year. He is also highly regarded as a massive influence and a direction to go to for learning in baseball. This interview is full of knowledge, as well as Ken talking about what led him to how he works in baseball and what's got him so good at what he's able to do. Now let's hear more from our guest, Ken Crenshaw. All right, so today we're sitting here chatting with the Director of Sports Medicine and Performance for the Arizona Diamondbacks, Ken Crenshaw. Ken, how's life going?
It's going great. It's going great, man. I'm glad to be a part of the podcast today, so I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah, this will be fun. So you're going to be presenting this January at the World Pitching Congress. Incredibly excited to hear everything you have to say and what you're going to bring to this. And I've heard you speak in the past, and you know, we've had conversations before, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. You know, most people in baseball, if not almost all people in baseball, know who you are, but people outside of like the direct baseball realm, I think need to know. So we're going to go into that a little bit more and kind of speak of your experiences and whatnot. You've worked, what, 30 years in baseball now?
Yeah, this is moving on to my 31st year this year, and it seems like I just started a couple years ago. So I'm still I'm getting older, but I'm excited, and I love the game, and I love the process of the way it's evolving.
That is insane. Just from all of the knowledge and experience that you could have gained through all this, and that you're still just continuing to grow and being a leader and pioneer in this industry, that you've taken all this information and used it appropriately. You've worked with the Pirates, the Braves, the Rays for several years, and now the Diamondbacks for the majority of your second half of your career, correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So you've worked in multiple positions, right? So you've
Talk about that a little bit. Yeah, no, I started as an athletic trainer, just kind of in between, college semesters, basically, back with the Pirates, just looking to get some sort of experience. I thought it would be a cool avenue to push myself forward. I was trying to actually get into physical therapy school, and then the Braves came at me with an opportunity to be the strength and conditioning coordinator and to start it from scratch, because they never had anything. That was in 1991. So I raised my hand and said, sure, I'll do it. Didn't know a whole lot about what I was getting into, but man, it was a really good opportunity, and then it also really challenged me to step outside of what I knew and try to learn something new. So, you know, I took that on as a strength and conditioning coordinator for 5 years with the Braves, and then I moved over to the Tampa Rays, which were an expansion team, so we started everything from scratch. And I think that was my first kind of piece of being able to pull a whole team together, not only, you know, the medical side of it or athletic training side, rehab, and then also the performance side. So I was able to pick every person that came on the ground floor, and then, you know, we built it over about a 3-year period, and we were up and running in 1998 full bore. We started in 96, but it was a great experience, and you know, it was my kind of first concept of how you build a team. And I guess if I had to say something that I'm actually okay at today, it would be that, building a team and culture and things like that.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later. I got some stuff I want to talk about with that. So going into your position with the Pirates, was there like an event before that that kind of got you going into athletic training or in that direction?
Yeah, no, I you know, I grew up playing sports. My dad was a football player, played at New Mexico State, played for the Eagles a couple years. So, you know, we just kind of grew up very sports-oriented family. I have an older sister, and, you know, we played football, basketball, and track. Didn't know anything about baseball. I know that. So I ended up going to New Mexico State. I had a football scholarship, but I was really adamant that I wanted to be a basketball player. So I denied that and then tried to play basketball. I ended up tearing my ACL right out of the chute. And they got me into the training room, and I was just like, man, this is really cool. And I think at that point, too, I'd kind of realized I'm probably not good enough to play with these guys. So, man, I just took a different road at that point. You know, the ACL tear kind of brought real life to me. So I thought that was it was pretty cool.
It's crazy how there always seems to be some form of injury or a major event that leads people to getting a better understanding or like really taking over their discipline. Like anyone that has achieved something in their realm or whatever they do seems to have had some form of drive or passion or something that I don't want to say triggered, but that pushed them to work hard to be the best because of something that happened to them. So that's really interesting. And that seems to be the one thing that overlaps in almost all these stories with some of the people that we talk with, like the presenters for this World Pigeon Congress and anyone else that we've kind of had this conversation with, is there's always seems to be something that's really like a driving force behind that. And injury seems to be a very common one, which is unfortunate though.
It is, but you know, it gave me the direction that I needed to go where I've gone. You know, if had that not happened, who knows where I would have been. So it's kind of a blessing in disguise.
It's true. So you've worked in, you know, minor league baseball. You've worked as the athletic trainer, the conditioning coordinator, head trainer. Now your new position is the director of sports medicine and performance, which is that kind of like when they make the GM the head of baseball operations, now the head trainer is now the director of sports medicine and performance. Is that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I think, you know, in general, it's always been a struggle between the departments when you look at, you know, the medical side of it or the athletic training side and the performance side. You know, I think in a lot of organizations and colleges and high schools, they don't always see eye to eye. You know, it's like, hey, we're going to do our thing and you guys do your thing and we'll try to meet in the middle if it works. And if not, we just won't meet in the middle. And obviously I've had experience in both, which is pretty unique. You know, not many athletic trainers have been strength and conditioning coordinators and vice versa. You know, not many strength and conditioning coordinators have been athletic trainers. There are a few. So it gives me a unique perspective to be able to look into both areas, be able to relate to people in both areas and then bring that group together and say, hey, you know, what's our goal here? And, you know, what's our mission? What are we up to? And I think it's been, you know, really helpful for me because I feel like if I didn't have that experience in the strength and conditioning area, I would probably struggle with those guys.
Man, that's for one, that is dead on, because there is a dichotomy between front office and medical staff and training, and just the trying to appease everybody and stay on the same page is very difficult. It's so hard, right? Especially at the professional level. But the other part of this is you laid the foundation perfectly for the next question I was going to ask, is how important is it for you to rise through the ranks through multiple positions to be able to tell what works great and what needs to be changed?
I think it's critically important. You know, I read a quote one time or an article about Bill Belichick, and, you know, I always admire people that are really good at what they do. I'm not sitting here saying I'm a Patriots fan, but I really respect what the Patriots do. It's just amazing to watch how they've just been successful year after year after year. And so you got to start asking yourself, well, what are they doing really good? But anyway, this quote from the reporter was talking about Belichick, or I think it might have been one of his coaches, but he just said, hey, he can go be the running backs coach, he can be the offensive line coach, he could be the receivers coach, he could be the quarterback coach, and he would be the best coach in that area because he knows all of the areas really well. And that always stuck with me. I'm like, you know, if you're going to be a leader and one that people want to follow and push your organization forward, you really need to know all of the pieces really well. And I'm not Bill Belichick good, but I feel like I've got a good rounded understanding of what each area is trying to do. And then at the same time, you know, allow them to do what they do well, and then maybe just give them some guidance. But you can't do that without, you know, understanding in each one of those areas.
Yeah, it is very important, and you do an amazing job from, you know, what I've seen, what I've heard from you, and then when everyone talks about you, that's one thing that you're doing a great job. And I think it even shows that 2004 and 2005, the training staff that you were running was the training staff of the year, correct?
Yeah, that was back in Tampa. And again, you know, I've been really lucky along my path, too, to be associated with quite a few really good people. And, you know, that was something that I was just learning at that time. Like I said before, it was kind of my first dive into pulling a team together. And I think one of the mistakes that, I don't know if it's a mistake, but it was just what I had at the moment, was me making the decision on who to hire. And I picked some really good ones, and I picked some really bad ones too. So I think the power and what I've learned since then is that the group, my team, you know, our team, our sports medicine and performance team, we are the ones that choose our teammates. I don't choose them. And I think there's a ton of power in that. I think people miss on that a lot. They want to be the person that picked, you know, the next hire. And, you know, when you do that, you'll make mistakes, because there's obviously points of view that you don't see. And I think that's the beauty of our team, is we may have, you know, 6 to 10 people interview you separately. And you may trick one or two of us, but you're not going to trick all 10 of us. So I think that's helped us. And it's, you know, it's definitely an advancement from where I was then to, you know, picking people. And I think, you know, when you look at selection, that's probably one of the most important areas that we focus on, is getting really good people.
Yeah. So I was going to mention this later, but I think this is a perfect segue into it, is your lineage of people that you've worked with or worked around or that have worked under you is massive. And like, people that are now running training staffs and they're head trainers and running, you know, the strength side and the medical side. And there's people, you know, littered all over Major League Baseball that have worked kind of under or around your lineage. And then I've even had, you know, stories of people telling me that Major League Baseball players are more accepting of working with trainers or medical staff if they hear that they're Ken Crenshaw approved, which is crazy. That's crazy to hear. But how does that make you feel?
Well, wow. I mean, that's news to me. I mean, I know I got a good lineage of people, but like, that's, you know, it's flattering to an extent. And, you know, it makes obviously what I do feel worthwhile, you know, because in life you kind of figure out as you get older, you know, well, why do I do all this crazy stuff? And I think it's kind of Simon Sinek's, you know, why? Like, why do you do it? So there was a period when I started asking myself that, like, why do I do this? And I came to the conclusion that I do it to develop people. You know, I just love to see people get better and get the same opportunities that I got. And, you know, so that, you know, you saying that means a lot to me. And it's certainly, I've been really lucky, you know, along the path to pick some really good people that made me better, that made our organization better. And I think it goes back to what I said, it's selection. If you can just really hone down what are you looking for, but don't be so adamant that you have to pick people that are just like you, because I've learned more from the people that have came to our organization that challenged us, you know, that would question why we do what we do. And I think those are the ones that make you really grow and continue to grow. So, again, like picking some really cool people along the way that have came here and made, you know, our team way better. And then, you know, they've went on and, you know, running their own programs now, and they're doing a great job. And, you know, I think if it is my kind of duty, I kind of look at it as a servant leader. I want to make sure that they have every possible tool they need to go out and be successful on another team. And I focus on that daily, like, how can I help them get to where they want to go? And it's just served me really well. And I think it served our team really well too.
Ken, that's fascinating that you mentioned Simon Sinek's Start With Why, because he just came out with a new book called, I think, The Infinite Game. And I haven't listened or read it yet, but from what I've heard is the premise is the idea that you're working towards something that doesn't have a finite finish, that it's an infinite thing. Like you're working to continue a lineage, make people better and continue to make them better, which it sounds like that's, you basically just read the outline of the book yourself.
Maybe I haven't read it yet, but I've read, you know, some of his original works, and they just make a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, you identify with things that make sense to you. But sometimes it's the things that don't make sense to you that challenge you, that make you better, make you grow outside of, you know, your point of view. And, you know, that why thing just means a lot to me, because I think early on in your career, anybody's career, they're just trying to gain, just gain ground on what they're doing personally. So it's a very inwardly focused motive. And I think, you know, I was in that boat too. I just, when I was younger, I'm just like, okay, I'm just trying to do a job. I'm trying to do it good. And, you know, how can I get my own skills better? And I've seen many people that have came through our organization, you know, people that I've picked from the beginning, and they're doing the same things. They're trying to accumulate skills and knowledge and all these things. And it's not until I can get them to see, hey, look, that's really cool that you have all of this skill and knowledge, expertise, but when are you going to actually help the next guy? When are you going to help them? That's when you really learn your craft, and that's when you change who you are to, you know, being somebody that's riding the boat to somebody that's actually directing the boat. So that's always been a passion of mine, just try to help other people understand leadership too, you know, like how can you become a really effective leader?
That's well said. Last November, I was watching morning baseball on MLB Network. It was the Japan All-Star Series with the Nippon Professional Baseball League, and they pan into the dugout, and there I see Ken Crenshaw.
I was there.
Yeah, what was Japan like? How was that whole series?
It was fantastic. It was my second trip over. I went back, I think, in 2004, maybe when I was with the Rays. We played the Yankees to open the season over there. And anyway, so it was my second trip there. But this one was with the Major League All-Star team. And so, you know, the stakes weren't as high, and it was a lot more, there was a lot more time to kind of investigate the country and just, you know, have time to relax and get to know a lot of different players and coaches and, you know, obviously other medical people that I was with and strength and conditioning people. It was a blast, man. I love Japan. It's just such a unique place, because the people are so committed to certain things that just are amazing to me. You know, when I sit back and I watch, I'm like, man, they are so committed. I just wish that we could as Americans maybe get some of that commitment that they have to certain things and you know, then rub off on what we do. So I kind of take the culture for what it's worth and then try to implement some of the things that they do. And, you know, one of them's I don't know if you've heard of the book called The Kaizen Way.
Mm-mm.
So, you know, it's doing these little steps, taking little steps. So if you're going to start working out, don't, you know, try to change the world in a day. You know, you take one step and one step leads to two steps and, you know, on and on. So, it's their process too. When you go see their country and the way they function, it's really cool.
Were you having to kind of tiptoe around usage of these athletes being in November, a month after the season ends, they're not really rested and recovered?
Yeah, no, that's the scariest part of it, because, you know, we had some really high profile players there too, mm-hmm. particularly on the position players side. You know, a lot of the pitchers, you know, big time pitchers didn't really want to go, and understandable at that point in time of the season, because it was in November. But the position players, I mean, we had some really high profile guys. And I think that was one of my concerns going in. I was like, oh man, I, you know, hurting one of these guys is not going to be good. So, you know, we're obviously traveling a lot. We're playing on you know, turf fields, which is totally different than what we're kind of used to here, the turf there and the turf here. And one of them was a grass field, but, you know, that whole experience was a little, it was fun, but it was also a little nerve-wracking. But we had agreed as a staff, you know, I mean, the coaches and the MLB people all agreed, hey, look, we got to be really smart with how we, you know, get these players playing full speed again after they've been off for a month or so. But it worked out well. Don Mattingly was the manager. Brent Strom was the pitching coach. And, you know, these are guys with a ton of experience, and they saw it for what it was worth, too. You know, hey, we're going over there to play baseball against the Japanese national team, but we're trying to spread baseball, you know, throughout the world. And I thought they just took a great approach at the way we put players into games, and, you know, we're protecting their interests.
Yeah, it's exactly like you said. Looking at that, I was like, man, I cannot believe the teams are okay with some of these guys that are going over. Like, that's a lot of money. Baseball's a big money business. Your people have to be healthy to play, and you know, a month after the season, they're not really recovered well, and you run that risk. But
no, absolutely.
You guys did a great job, though. So everything worked out good.
Well, we didn't. It's funny, we didn't play quite as well as you could tell. I feel like our guys were playing half speed and their guys were playing full speed, you know. And we lost a couple games in the end. I think we blew two or three games in the ninth. But it was a great experience, and I think everybody that went would agree with that, you know. Not that we won, or they won more games than we did. It was just a great experience. But we'd have liked to, I think, play better. If everybody reflected on it, they would have said that. So.
Cool. Let's go kind of in the direction of your day-to-day life. What would you say as basically your current position, what are some of your biggest challenges day-to-day?
That's a good question. I think from my standpoint, being kind of the overseer of about 35 people, I like to know what each person in each area needs from me to take them to new levels. That's always a challenge, is to sit down, you know, with that many people one-on-one and go, hey, what do you need from me to make you the best you can be and make your area the best it can be? So, you know, that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of one-on-one. It takes a lot of really good communication and connection to make all of that happen. And I think that's probably my biggest challenge, because you have your day-to-day things that you do too, and you know, you can get pulled away from the duty you may have on your mind in an instant. And in my position, you know, general manager starts calling and you got to go. So I think that's probably my biggest challenge. And I think the next biggest challenge on the list is just to, how do you communicate to everybody that you're dealing with from a you know, kind of an injury or playing standpoint. And that would include the general manager, the manager, the pitching coach or the hitting coach, your other staff members, physicians, you know, all of these people kind of working together to know, hey, this player has an issue. What are we going to do to make sure that, you know, he's moving back towards playing and being on the field as quickly as possible, as safely as possible? So there's I always tell people, when you get the head trainer's job, or you get even the position I'm in at right now, you're kind of an air traffic controller. You're constantly landing airplanes all day. You're just trying to make sure nobody crashes. You know, I'm going to put that plane on the ground. Okay, here comes another one. Let me put that plane on the ground. And, you know, that's a big part of what you do. And I think, fortunately or unfortunately, it depends on which way you look at it, it's just what you have to do to be really good at the profession now. You know, back 20 years ago, it was kind of hands-on skill, and we didn't have cell phones and, you know, the immediacy of communication that we do now. You know, things could wait a day or two, but not now. I mean, things just are moving ultra fast, and you have to be on top of it. And there's a couple of pieces that I didn't even mention, and that's obviously the player, and, you know, the players have agents, and, you know, so there's a lot of moving parts. So, yeah, you just got to, you got to be on it. You got to, it's a chess game too. You're constantly thinking, trying to think ahead, you know, hey, if I move this piece here, how does everything else fall into place? So I like it though. It's a challenge. It's something I've done for a while. I feel like it's one of the things that I'm pretty good at. So I can teach that, that process to, you know, the younger staff members, because that's always my goal, is for them to take my job. You know, I want them to you know, aspire to do that.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing a great job at it. Just looking at, like we talked about, the lineage of all your other people that have worked under you or around you that are, you know, running organizations, which is, you know, shows you're doing awesome at it.
I appreciate it.
So I remember we had dinner last year, just sitting there chatting over some wine and food here in St. Louis. And you mentioned Leon Chaitow. Mm-hmm. And go ahead and tell the listeners, you know, who he is if they don't already know. And then how did he influence you and how you work today?
Yeah, it's a good one. He was an osteopathic doctor from England. And I, by chance, had a meeting with him. I knew this other lady named Sandy Fritz, who was a manual therapist and a really good one from up around the Detroit area. And I had met her down at IMG Academies, you know, it was probably, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And I just went over and watched her work because I had a friend that was running the conditioning part of the academy. And he said, hey, this lady's really good manual therapist. And I was just kind of learning manual therapy at the time. Anyway, I met her. I mean, she did some fantastic stuff that I've never seen done before. And I just asked her, I said, well, who'd you learn that from? And she said, oh, well, I had studied with Leon for a year. And I went, okay, well, who's that? And anyway, I started investigating who he was. And then I figured out that he's kind of like the Michael Jordan of osteopathic doctors. And he's since passed away a few years ago. But, man, he's a legend. If you look him up, he's just incredible. So Sandy ended up introducing me to Leon. And you know, it's kind of like getting introduced to Michael Jordan. And he says, hey, you want to play a pickup game? And I'm like, sure. So the game he wanted to play was, hey, do you mind writing a chapter about sports and how you use muscle energy techniques in my revised muscle energy techniques book? And I'm not a real good writer, but I knew that when Michael Jordan asked to play a pickup game, you got to say yes. Mm. So I said yes, and I jumped on and I wrote a chapter the best I could and tried to, you know, I mean, he gave me a ton of direction on how to really put it together and make it actually look good in a book. So I'm giving him all the credit. But, you know, after that, man, he took me to places that I couldn't even believe that I could get to, you know, because of his connections and what he knew too, man. He was such an incredible teacher, one of the most gifted manual, therapist that I've ever worked with. I mean, his touch and his thought process and all that just started, you know, a path for me that's been unbelievably incredible. He's, you know, obviously a European, and I think a lot of our philosophy and a lot of my philosophy is very European. I just feel like some of the stuff that they were doing from a manual standpoint was just beyond what we were getting educated on here in the States, for sure. And I think as of late, you know, it's evolved quite a bit. I mean, there's quite a few, you know, manual therapy courses now that you can get your knowledge with here in the States. But, you know, mine was started there. So I'm kind of biased towards Leon and all of the things that he taught me.
That's really cool. Thanks for that. Yeah. What other resources, like whether it's a book or a method or technique, would you say has influenced your perspective other than what we just talked about with Leon?
In terms of manual therapy or just overall?
Just overall, just everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've had plenty of people that have influenced me along my path. You know, I mean, I grew up on a cattle ranch in New Mexico, and my parents were really influential on my values and just work ethic in general. I think when you grow up on a ranch, the one thing you know how to do is work. I mean, like, you have to.
You don't have a choice.
Cows don't take Sundays off, so it's like you work, you know. And that was something I actually told I went down to New Mexico State yesterday and talked to their students, which is where I graduated. And I told him that, the same thing. I said, look, I just, that was one thing I knew how to do was work. I mean, I wasn't the smartest guy, but I knew how to work. And I think that really influenced a lot of my path and the people that gave me opportunities. You know, they looked at me and said, man, this guy has got a good work ethic. So, you know, I kind of give my parents credit for that and instilling the values that I have. And then I had a couple other people along my path too. Had a high school basketball coach named Ron Becker who, man, he changed my life. He just gave me some he gave me some advice at the right time in my life when I needed it. And it kind of involved being focused on whatever you were doing at that time being the most important thing that you did in your life. And when you're able to simplify it like that and break it down, I think it just made a lot of sense to me. And then, you know, he kind of taught me later on. I started, you know, after I had played for him in high school, I went back and started coaching with him later on. And, you know, he taught me the why behind what he was doing. And so many times it was about things in life. It wasn't necessarily about basketball. It was like, how could he make a kid better understanding of what he was going to face in life? And he, you know, he changed my life for sure. I thought he was really influential. I had another guy named Ricky Mendini, who was a head trainer at New Mexico State. Back in the day, he just, he taught me, how kind of to relate to people. He was just a master at making everybody, that came in that was hurt, feel like they were going to be okay. You're going to be okay. I got this thing. And, you know, the clinical stuff that he taught me too is important, but just the way he related to people. And I think that the amount of information that he could take in and not forget it was something that always stuck in my mind. It's kind of like that air traffic controller. He was master at it. He could just take a lot in. And then 2 days later, you had told him something 2 days ago and you thought he might forget it. And boom, there he is. And he remembers it. And you're like, how does he remember all that? You know? And, he was a really big impact on my learning and my ability to connect with people when I was in college. And then, you know, Jamie Reed was another guy that I worked with in Tampa. You know, he's kind of a legend too, from the athletic training standpoint. And, you know, he worked with the Orioles and he worked with us in Tampa. And then he's still with the Rangers now. And I think the thing that I learned from him was, you know, how to communicate to everyone, you know, coaches and players you know, front office people and other staff. He was just a really good communicator. I watched him. I got to sit beside him for 5 years and just watched the way he did it. And he wasn't so much the guy that would tell you how to do it. I learned by his example, and I thought he was incredible. And I think, you know, right now the biggest influence I have is my team. You know, my current team is, and they're unbelievably talented. They're so much better than me. You had touched on it earlier. You know, when you pick really smart people that are better than you, they just make you better. So
you do have a really good team.
Yeah, they're incredibly good. So I got to sit back and check myself half the time, because I'm like, you know, we're talking about Ben Hagar and Ryan DePanflo and Nate Shaw, you know, some of our more veteran guys have been around, and they got me spinning half the time. I'm sitting there going, okay, can you explain that again? I'm not quite getting it. So you start to realize where your strengths and weaknesses are. And I think that's, again, that's what I do well, is I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at, and I know what they're good at and not good at. And that's why we play, I think, well together as a team, is like, hey, let's let the best person take on whatever it is that needs to be done that day. Not, you know, let's don't get selfish and try to be the guy that's got the answer. Let's just put the best person in that thing. So they challenge me every day, and they're a big influence on me continuing to push forward.
I love that. Keep showing your toes.
Absolutely.
So switching it up a little bit, same idea, but more along the lines of, for the listeners, what resources would you recommend to someone looking to grow and learn in their discipline, whether that's physical therapy, chiropractor, athletic trainer, they're a pitching coach, hitting coach. What are some, you know, whether it's movement, like that's the one thing mm-hmm. that I hear a lot. And one reason why I think this is going to be this event coming up is going to be really important for all assets of, or all regions or disciplines, is that I always hear like from the pitching guys, like what can I do to learn more about movement and how the body should move and all this? And then I hear from the strength and conditioning side, what can I, you know, do to be able to kind of make the medical side their job easier by not screwing them up or doing this, this, or that. So like trying to kind of, you know, bridge that gap and find a good communication or language amongst everybody, but then also still learn a little bit of what everyone does.
Yeah, no, that's it's a great question because we constantly have to evaluate that in our own team and how are we, you know, educating our interns and our younger staff members. And I think the first step, I'm a really simple fundamental guy. I'm an old coach at heart. I've coached basketball for, you know, 20 some years. And I just think, okay, what are the fundamentals? What are the simple things that you can do that you can take care of on your own? My basketball coach, Ron Becker, the one that he said, look, you can learn how to shoot and dribble on your own. Like you don't need me to have a formal practice for you to understand that. And that made a lot of sense to me. So I kind of carry that over into, you know, some of the things that we preach to our people. Like, look, anatomy and function, you know, there's multiple books and apps and things like that. I think you have, that's just a base, it's a base rock of what we're about and our, I guess, style. You need to know that. So that's kind of on you, you know, and anybody can do that. And we have these constant quizzes internally for the younger ones, or even older ones, you know. It's like, you know, every day we're going to have an anatomy quiz and we just think it's important. And then the way you actually see function may be different, you know, from who you learned it from. And, you know, our idea of function is kind of different than I think the American style of what was taught or what I learned in college. And that's, you know, it has a very, DNS base. I think we kind of function off of that, dynamic neuromuscular stabilization base. Postural Restoration Institute is kind of another, you know, it's a base of understanding of how function actually works. And so I think, you know, they all have websites and they have seminars and those type of things, you know, we constantly push is like, hey, look, you need to start here. I think it's giving somebody the direction so they're not chasing their tail or taking unnecessary classes is the key to me. So, you know, we kind of have a curriculum of, hey, look, if you're a first year person with our organization, look, take these courses just so you can get the fundamentals. I think obviously reading to me is something that always I didn't understand when I was younger. But now I'm just like, you can learn on your own so much just reading or audiobooks, you know, like you're stuck in traffic somewhere, have an audiobook going. Or what we're doing right now, podcasts, you know, I've learned a lot just listening to other people and getting their thoughts on stuff. So if I could backtrack just a little bit, I would say start with a solid mentor, somebody that you see that is really good and you're like, hey, you know, how did this guy get to where he's at? It's kind of like my story with Sandy Fritz. I just wanted to know how she got so good because she was really good. She showed me some stuff that I was like game changer. And I'm like, well, where did you get what you got? And I think I learned from another guy named Willem Kramers from the Netherlands. He worked with us in 2007. And he was a physiotherapist from the Netherlands. And he was incredibly good. And so I started out, well, how did you get what you got? And I think having those mentors will help you kind of backtrack on some of the fundamental things that you need to have to be great. And so I always tell people, you know, have a mentor. And maybe it's somebody on our own team or multiple people on our own team, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's someone outside of here. And that's the beauty of what we got, too. We got so many talented people, you know. It's like you go – well, let me go talk to Ben. Okay, Ben, how did you get to where you got? And you can kind of backtrack on his thing. The toughest part for me is what it took me 15 years to learn. I can teach somebody in 3. So it's actually kind of frustrating. You're like, geez. And I had to grind this thing out for 15 years to even figure this out, and I can teach it to you in 3. But I think having that mentor, you know, obviously with the web now and the way you can go look at stuff, I think it's just really having a plan and not getting Sidetracked is one of the things I would recommend, because it's easy to get out on the internet and pick up a lot of ideas, and none of them have really been tested in the environment that you may work, and therefore they may not be applicable to you. So you have to have some direction. I think that mentor route can give you that.
I think that's really good. And that's another topic that's been discussed on multiple of these interviews, is the value of having a mentor to help guide your direction. Just because, like, we're in the era of anybody can post anything on Twitter and social media, and you get enough followers and then people think that you have influence and you know what you're talking about. When in all reality, like, you might be just sputtering BS that you put together or that you saw somewhere and you packaged it really well. But there's no real, you know, backing behind some of the stuff you're saying, or you don't really understand what you're trying to say. We're in like this weird state of deception. So, you know, having someone that's a, you know, a really good mentor to help guide your direction and tell, you know, give you a little bit, like I said, guidance to find a good direction to learn and to grow is massively important.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's like you said, there's so many things out there that again, someone's getting a lot of follows, but it may not be applicable at all to what, you know, actually works. And I always say down in the dungeon, you know, where things really go down, you got to know that it works. I'm a big believer in, you know, if something works, I'm going to hang on to it. If it doesn't work, then we're getting rid of it. So that's the really tough thing for a lot of the younger people to try to sift through. I think a lot of times you have so many things coming at you that it's easy to get sidetracked and maybe go down a rabbit hole that's not very productive.
Ken, I know a couple things that I think just shows how good of a teacher and a leader you are is that, well, for one, you mentioned that what took you 15 years, you can basically teach in 3 years now from just breaking it all down and knowing what to expect and what they need to learn. But then the other side of that is talking to people you work with or people that you have worked with or that know you. With all the things that you have learned over 30 years in baseball, from all the muscle techniques and the manual manipulation and the, you know, PRI or DNS, all these other certain forms of rehabilitation and strength training that you know, they still say your best asset is your ability to lead a group. So, which is, people don't realize if they don't know all the stuff that we just mentioned, that says a ton. That says so much, because that's a lot of knowledge and it's a lot of learning. So I think that's something that I can definitely commend you for is just if you already have all that knowledge already and you can still have your best asset be that you're a good leader, I think that speaks volumes of what you can truly achieve.
I appreciated it, you know, and again, it hasn't been an easy process. You know, it's one of those things where I think as a group, we sift through what is relevant and what's not. And we constantly communicate on the best process for getting our player back out on the field or having our player go out in the field and perform at his best. And, you know, that process is tricky. And, you know, to actually have someone, you know, say what you just said, is it means a lot to me, because that's one of the things I constantly focus on is how can I be a good leader for the rest of the people, and, you know, not be afraid to step outside of the box and do something that, you know, not everybody else may agree with or sees fit. And, you know, I'm okay with that. I just think, you know, you got to be fearless at times and just say, hey, this is the path that we're going to take. And it, you know, it's got to be thought out. It's got to be well thought out. It can't just be, you know, a random path. So I appreciate your compliments.
There's two things I want to dive deeper in from what you just said. So one is, what's a common belief in baseball or training that you believe is completely false, that you just think is total BS?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's a really hot topic right now for me is you know, this year-round throwing and youth specialization. And to me, it's just like, it's super simple to me. I just don't see it as complicated as what everybody's trying to make it. And I think, first of all, I want to, you know, look at it, take a step back and go, okay, what does the science say? And I think the science says, you know, for a youth player, throwing year round is not good. You know, you're gonna increase the chances of injury, I don't know, even fivefold. I mean, there's quite a few studies out there that are showing that it's not good. So that would be the first start for me. And secondly, I've seen it on our end of it. You know, we're at the very elite level. So we get all of the products of a lot of intense throwing or throwing in general that are coming to us in the draft. And so the draft medicals have went from, I don't know, relatively mild to extreme in the last 5 to 10 years. And I think it's a product of kids throwing too much. I mean, there's so many things going on. I've got two kids and playing baseball in college, and one in senior in high school. And so I've been through all of the, you know, the club ball tournaments and the showcases and all these things. And I sit there and watch, you know, kid after kid go through things that we would never put our major league players in from a throwing standpoint, pitching particularly. So I'm like, yes, specialized is the thing that scares me the most. I would say let kids play multiple sports. And I think, you know, that's easy for me to say. I've really tried to practice it with my own kids, but parents feel like they're getting behind, and you know, I gotta be doing this all the time. But when you start digging into our major league players, you figure out, I always ask them, hey, when did you start playing baseball? How old were you? And did you just play baseball? I mean, very few of them just did one thing. And I think that to me is such a profound shift in the way people are thinking right now that it kind of scares me, because I think a lot of the people that are promoting are people that are on the outside of baseball making money off of people that are in baseball and kind of utilizing that to their advantage. But so if they can't work with somebody, you know, kind of during their off season program or during the season, how else do they promote it? And then I think it's extended out to, oh, we need to throw year round. And, you know, I would say that one scares me. You know, I've been lucky to be associated with some super elite pitchers, some Hall of Famers. And I'm not saying what they did then is exactly right, but I never saw them throw year round. And at the same time, I'm still trying to investigate, you know, is there maybe a little happy medium in here where we can continue to throw, but at a lesser intensity, you know, that keeps that arm, you know, almost conditioned so that when they do ramp it up, I think it's a lot safer. So, you know, that one to me is what I just hear it a lot. And I'm like, I disagree. And you know, these are the reasons that I disagree are, you know, based off of science and then based off my own experience. But baseball, I think, is not easy. It doesn't matter which way you look at the game, whether you're trying to hit the ball or you're trying to throw the ball to a certain spot or catch it, the game's not easy. So don't make it more complicated than what it is.
Yeah, kind of. So the whole workload measurement thing and the acute chronic workload ideas is, it's a hot topic right now, and it's, you know, we're finding out more and more that maybe it's not as cut and dry as a certain percent increase per week, per month, per whatever. And I do think there's still a lot more we need to learn before we just implement it in every single organization and every single throwing program. But I do think that's, you know, you're spot on with that and that idea. Along the lines of, you know, talking about keeping pitchers healthy and, you know, it's obviously it's a sign of a good organization if you're, you know, staying healthy and performing well. Did you see there was an article that was posted either today or yesterday, cost analysis of TJ surgery or Tommy John surgery for Major League Baseball teams. So it was in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, 194 pitchers between 2004 and 2014, showed that I think starters averaged $1.9 million per player in financial money lost. And then closers were $3.9 million per player in money lost from the team. And then the other stat I thought was interesting was that it showed that only 77% returned to Major League Baseball, you know, playing. And I think the crazy thing when people hear about that is they think, oh, it's, you know, I'm going to come back stronger, I'm going to come back better. And in all reality, it's still kind of a toss up. And even though it's a very good surgery and the rehab is normally pretty effective, Even at the major league level, when you have the best training and medical staff and rehab, people still don't make it back.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's kind of a false perception is, you know, that they are going to come back and they're going to throw harder. And you just gave the stats that are, you know, pretty accurate amongst multiple studies. So, I agree with you, man. Like how can we prevent these things? And I think that's what we're all digging on. But I mean, when you look at all of the factors that are added into why they may occur, I mean, it's multifactorial. And then the thing too, that in our last topic about, you know, each player's is a different player and they individually can handle different workloads. And I think what we're doing is being able to try to understand what each player's workload is too, not just, hey, there's an acute to chronic workload. And, you know, if we stay within this ratio with everybody, we're going to be okay. Now, some guys can take more and some guys can't take more. And I think it's learning who those guys are before they actually break is kind of a key. So, you know, I'm with you, man. There's a lot of money lost, and you know, it's been something that I think we're all trying to figure out. Everybody in baseball is, and nobody's got the answers here. Even people from the outside that don't deal with what we deal with day to day, saying, "Oh yeah, no, this is you just do this, and we're not going to have any more Tommy Johns, or we're going to have way less." And you know, I wish I could sign on to somebody right now, but I'm like, this thing's multifactorial, and it's not a simple thing. So, you know, players are, you know, harder every year. If you look at the increase of velocity over the last 10 years, it's kind of crazy. So, you know, there's a limitation to how much stress the body can take. And I think, you know, that's our job as clinicians is to try to figure out, you know, what's that limit and maybe we can kind of guide that along the way.
Yeah, exactly. So we're having a little bit of a poor connection. I don't know if I can hear you okay right now, I think. So some of that was a little chopped up. But basically what you're saying is it's so multifactorial. There's so much going on. It's hard to pinpoint, you know, one program or system for each individual person just from all the many facets that, you know, each person is different. Their bodies are different. They develop different. And you can't just say this person does this by this metric. You have to adapt to their personal metrics or variables.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It was exactly.
Yeah. What, where do you think baseball is going to be in the next 5 years? You've seen it for the last 30 years develop into what it is right now. What do you think the next 5 years look like?
Mm-hmm. Like, are you referring, you know, in terms of the way the players are going to evolve or staff or training or
more what? Of the way the front offices are putting together staffs and the way that we're looking at training and the way that we're pushing the limits and what's the next big thing, you know, the Moneyball 2.0.
Yeah. Well, I personally feel like when you start to break down movement efficiency, you know, how are our pitchers moving well and hopefully helps improve their performance and decrease, you know, the injuries that we just talked about. And the same thing on the hitting front. I feel like the pitching is a little ahead of where the hitting is, but, you know, finding better training programs that are going to improve movement efficiency. And, you know, there's a lot of things out there now with variability training, constraints-based training, you know, just the whole skill acquisition understanding, I think, is evolving quite quickly. And you need to understand it because I think there's plenty of things in there that maybe from a strength and conditioning standpoint or performance standpoint that we probably shunned, you know, 5 to 10 years ago is coming on strong. And I've seen some of the effectiveness of utilizing a different method of getting a player to understand, you know, how to increase his movement efficiency. And then it shows up on the mound. And, you know, I think long term it may show up in terms of, you know, less stress on the body and fewer injuries. So that's one for me for sure. And I think the other one is just, you know, there's kind of this cueing epidemic that's going on. And you know, what you're actually instructing a player to do and what they're actually understanding may be two different things. So I think, you know, coaches are going to have to continue to develop themselves. I think for the years that I've been in baseball, a lot of times coaches, you know, they coach during the season, and when they hit the off season, they're off, you know, and not anymore. I mean, there's just so much information out there to try to be understood that you have to be on it even in the off season. And if you're not, guess what? The player's going to be, and he's going to be asking outside sources for their information. And then if they start, you know, having some success, which many of people have outside the game, there's plenty of throwing centers and hitting centers that players are getting information at, and that just decreases the credibility of the people inside the game if they're not, I guess, evolving their own thought processes and learning. So I just think, you know, continued education and understanding of maybe cueing and you know, constraints-based learning and variability training and all of the things down that line have to be on point. If not, you know, the old school coach or the old school athletic trainer or conditioning guy like myself gets lapped. So I think you have to be on that.
Very good. So we'll start closing up this. We're kind of getting close to the hour mark. Do you want to give a little sneak peek about what you're going to be presenting on in January?
Well, yeah, that's that's evolving too. You know, I guess the more I obviously work with Ben Hagar here, who's going to be one of the presenters. And, you know, I know we work together quite closely with movement efficiency and just, you know, how a pitcher moves and what may be more ideal to decrease the amount of stress and also improve their performance. So I kind of got a sneak peek into what he's going to do. And then I've talked to a few other people that are presenting there. So I think, you know, I'm going to stick with my strength, and that's kind of taking the broad view of what everybody's talking about, and then kind of explaining how we as an organization put all of these pieces together, because the people presenting at the seminar are coming from different areas, but I know a lot of us have very like-minded stuff because I've talked to most of the people. But it's, I think that the tough thing is you can get all of these ideas and you can get all of these maybe drills and different, you know, things that you can implement, but it's like you go back to the shop on Monday, how do you implement it all, and what do you implement? And I think that's where I can come in and give it some direction on how we would do it and how it, you know, can't get muddied down for the player, or if it's the coach, how we all work together and collectively, you know, have a mindset of working together and understanding the player's limitations and what we can do to improve those limitations. And I think that's the thing that I'm going to try to hit home on the most. It sounds almost too simple, but the more I talk about teams and building teams and culture and all these other things, I just keep going back to that. And every time I've ever done it with a group of people, they're like, wow, that's really good. Like, how'd you come up with that? And I'm like, it's just really simple to me, but it's really not. So I'm going to go back to my old basketball coaching days and just teach the really five fundamentals of basketball, which are shoot, pass, catch, dribble, and play good defense. So we're not going to talk about fancy offenses or, you know, tricky press breakers and all that stuff. We're just going to talk about the fundamentals.
I love it. Well, I'm excited for it. Is there anything else you want to get off your chest while we're still on?
No, I'm super excited. I know a lot of our actually coaches are going, and I think that's the new frontier. Is we're just going to have a lot of skills coaches that are involved, and I think there's going to be a challenge for all of us that are in the clinical world to be able to break our information down so that a coach that doesn't have the same knowledge of what we have can understand it. And then secondarily is like, you have all this knowledge, how can you break it down for a player to understand it? And I think that's going to be the really cool and unique challenge to do at this upcoming seminar. And at the same time, just learn from each other, because there's so many cool people that are involved. I just think it's going to be a massive eye-opening experience. And I think we're going to look up and, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, have it at a different place and, you know, accommodate a lot of people. So I'm excited.
Yeah. Ken, I am so pumped for this. I got chills thinking about it. It's going to be so fun. It's going to be a blast.
Nice. Well, I appreciate you having me on today. It's been great talking to you, too. And I'm looking forward to it.
All right. And there you have it from Ken. Again, you can hear more from him or learn from him and speak to him in person at the upcoming World Pitching Congress here in January. He's excited. I'm excited. Everyone that I've talked to about this is pumped. It's going to be an insane event. You get to learn more about movement and baseball and injuries and rehab and training and performance and literally every aspect that you need in working with pitching. We're bringing it all together. So this is going to be an incredible event. Ken's going to bring some thunder. He is excited. I'm excited, like I said. And then we're going to just continue to grow and learn and develop. So get your tickets. They're going quick. We're starting to get more to pick up from the Major League Baseball realm. So once that starts to get going, they're probably not going to last as long. So if you're interested, jump on it now. This is going to be a phenomenal event. Thanks for listening. If you're a player or coach and you're looking for a more efficient way to warm up, check out our free dynamic warm-up ebook. This warm-up consists of evidence-based movements revolved around neuromuscular stability and fascial slings. You can download it off of our website or just go to the Gestalt Performance Twitter page and follow the link.